Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Has Barack Obama's presidency changed the way Americans talk about race? And does his race affect the way Americans talk about his presidency? Former President Jimmy Carter has gone on the record to say he believes Joe Wilson's "you lie" outburst during Mr. Obama's address to Congress this month reflected a broad pattern of racism by Americans who do not believe an African American should hold the country's highest office. President Obama himself has made a point of refusing to engage in speculation over whether his racial identity fuels at least some of his critics' dissatisfaction with his leadership. But the discussion continues in many other places, including the offices of the Dallas Morning News, where cubicle neighboring columnists Steve Blow and James Ragland have covered it in an occasional series called Talking Race. James, Steve, it's always a pleasure. Welcome back to Think.
Thanks. Good to be here.
I want to start with this. I'll ask each of you this, your first thoughts when you heard Joe Wilson shout out during that joint address to Congress?
I think hanging out with James has rubbed off on me. I'm not sure I would have thought race, but I did. You know, I just, as soon as I sort of heard that and I saw the sort of look of perplexed, bemused, I'm not sure how to describe the look that was on Obama's face when that came out. Anybody was watching, I think, remembers the moment where he sort of paused as if, should I acknowledge that? Should I, you know? But it came to my mind. I didn't know at that point who said it, anything about it, but I just thought, what an act of disrespect. And I wonder if in some way that's not tied to some underlying subtle attitude that says, this is a person that I can shout at, you know, meaning the president, a president of color. Now, you know, I don't know. Maybe, James, have you rubbed off on me too much?
You know, because my initial reaction wasn't immediately that this was sort of a, you know, was grounded in, you know, sort of racism or bigotry. I thought it was entirely inappropriate. I was sort of stunned. I mean, having worked in Washington before and knowing that in prior speeches that folks have gotten sort of hissed and booed, maybe in sort of subdued fashion, it just struck me that we've sort of lost our way in terms of knowing how to vent our frustrations, our disagreements, and it was a complete lack of decorum. Now, my gut reaction after sort of a few minutes later, I did go to the next level and begin to wonder if that sort of a comment wasn't grounded in something else. And I hated thinking that way because I don't know Joe Wilson from Adam. I've never really covered him and don't know much about him. I didn't know much about him at that time. So, but there you go. That's what we're all left to ponder when something like that happens.
It's interesting to me that the president has refused to jump into the fray on this, and I'm curious as to whether either of you thinks that that genuinely reflects his desire to sort of move beyond race in running the country, or does it represent something more like an understanding that he has nothing to gain politically and a lot to lose by taking a stand on something like this?
I think there's a little bit of both. I do think he wants to find some way to put the race issue behind him in terms of his presidency. I don't think he wants to be defined entirely, his presidency defined entirely by the fact that he's the first, mixed race, first African-American president. But he also hasn't shied away from talking about the issue of race. But I think he learned the lesson after the Gates incident that it's best not to have a knee-jerk reaction or response every time you sort of confront it with the hint of a comment that's made that others might suggest is sort of grounded in racism. So I think he's walking a really fine line here in terms of like not wanting the nation to be so divided on this issue and really wanting to create an atmosphere in which we can sort of talk about issues that in some respects are sort of defined, there are racial aspects to them, whether you're talking about poverty, crime and those sorts of issues. We got to be able to constructively talk about those in a way that's not incendiary.
Yeah, I think it's just good politics to try to stay above it. You know, there's nothing to be gained there by him engaging in that discussion. It's interesting to me that how the race card has kind of become this, it's almost like a judo move where in the beginning, you know, the idea of playing the race card was something that supposedly minorities did to shut down discussion. You play the race card and that's the Trump card. You know, there can be no more discussion since then. Since then, the reverse has happened, and that is the accusation of playing the race card becomes a conversation ender. It's like, you know, we can't think you know, just try to have a thoughtful discussion about could race play a role in some of this? Because immediately people say, you're playing the race card. And it's like, you know, that they try to shut the conversation down right there. And so while I certainly don't advocate playing the race card lightly, I also I have to say I sure hope we don't reach the point where race is just a taboo topic, you know, that we can't have thoughtful discussions about it. And
that's a great point, because I for one sort of applauded. I sort of took issue with, at some level, I think the way the former president, Jimmy Carter, characterized what was happening. I think perhaps he painted with too broad a brush. I think the way he sort of couched his comments sort of invited partisan attacks on him, and maybe to some extent on the president. That said, I thought it took a tremendous amount of courage and passion, really, to give voice to something that he himself, from his perch, could see and understand, and sort of knowing the history of the South and knowing the history of his own state of Georgia and knowing the history of race relations in this country, to say that what I see, to me, strikes me as being heavily coded in bigotry and racism. I applaud him for having the courage to say that, even if he overstated the degree of the problem.
You know, what you mentioned, Steve, about the race card sort of parallels the issue of the accusation of the label of racism. I think almost everyone in this country can agree that racism still exists, although almost everybody asked will say, it's not me, but I know other people
right,
who are racist,
exactly.
You know.
Yeah.
But you know, we have decided as a society that being labeled a racist is about the worst thing you can say about someone. There may be a couple things involving, you know, child abuse, but that's
right.
That's pretty much it. And I wonder what that means to us, that is the most damning label we can put on someone in terms of the ability to openly and honestly discuss what we really think about things.
I mean, I think especially people of color. If I can speak as the white guy, speaking of people of color.
Careful.
Steve Blow now representing
right.
all white America.
Exactly. Speaking for white America. I certainly get and the idea that we, you know, you have to be careful about playing the race card, and I would think that it really doesn't happen that very much. But I happened to be in kind of a roundtable discussion just one night last week, and it was a very multicultural sort of group, and we were actually talking about public education, so it wasn't even on the topic of race. But a fellow made a point about housing patterns and why people move to different areas, and it was a fairly innocuous thing. And a woman in the group, just a black woman, you could just see it. She immediately bristled and shot back to him, that is a very racist, prejudicial thing to say. And, you know, it was a conversation stopper. You know, what could he say in reply? And so, man, you know, we just got to be so careful about, you know, not using it in that way as a club. But again, you know, coming because it is. It's, you know, like you say, Chris, it's about the worst thing you can be called these days.
You know, I think it's a reflection of just sort of the long and sort of tortured history that we've experienced in this country on that issue. And in some ways, we've advanced considerably on the issue of race. I mean, institutions have changed, society has changed. Neighborhoods have changed, towns have changed, and so forth. Workplaces have changed. So we are in some ways able to sort of talk with each other and interact with each other, but there's still sort of that history there. I mean, just the other day, it was one of my younger colleagues was in the office, and I don't sit too far from him, and he rushed up to his editor, and I hope I don't get in trouble for this inside.
well, just leave the names out.
But he asked, his question was, he was writing about someone. He said, can I say black? And I immediately stood up, being sort of the race guy in the room there,
and class
representing
clown.
All black people,
representing all black people, and I just sort of chuckled. So I walked over, and so his editor began to sort of talk with him about that. I said, "Well, is he?" So my joke with the editor was, "How often would it be if you said yes, you can call him black, and you found out he's not black, and the reporter just wants to see if he could call him that?" But that's an example. Our language has changed. I mean, what you call, you know, African Americans or black people has changed, and people are sensitive about that.
Hypersensitive, obviously.
Yeah, hypersensitive about that. But again, we have a long history on this topic, And having the first black president in the office now has made people really sort of dance around it in sort of strange and unique ways. And so I think we do have to be able to kind of keep talking about it and talking about it in language that we all understand.
Well, and it's tough to talk about now because we're not talking about overt racism. We're not talking about David Dukes or, you know, Klan or that sort of thing. I think especially in this latest thing about, you know, Obama and reaction to Obama, we're talking about something that's more subtle than an avowed, you know, philosophy on race. And so that makes it, you know, even more difficult to talk about. I mean, James and I both in that last Talking Race column made the point, no one is saying that all opposition to Obama is rooted in race. That obviously, you know, there are political, philosophical differences that have nothing to do with it. I would never say that most people show up at Tea Party rallies because they have racial antipathy for the president. But with that said, I think it's also worth thinking about for all of us if our more subtle racial attitudes and beliefs don't come to play, you know, in some of our thoughts about the president, pro and con. Emails I get from white folks, there's a lot of resentment at this notion that all black people voted for Obama because he's black. And if that's not racist, I don't know what is, you know. And
part of it, Chris, the term gets banded about way too much. I think people, if not the race card, use the race term, calling someone a racist far too quickly, too readily. I mean, the sort of the old concept, you know, the racism being sort of an institutional thing, institutional oppression. And there are a lot of folks amongst us on both sides of the dividing line who may be bigoted, may be prejudiced, and their attitudes about race may come out in the language they use, the company they keep, and so forth. But I do think we do sort of use to call someone racist real quickly, kind of shut down the conversation to kind of gain an upper hand in the debate or negotiations, if you will, about issues. And we have to be careful about that.
Do you think it made a difference that Joe Wilson is from South Carolina and not from Nevada or Massachusetts or Michigan?
Honestly, yes. I think because of that whole Southern strategy, yeah. You can't look at the last half of the 20th century and look at the Republican strategy for winning the South and how they manage politics and discount that. I think there may have been some reaction either way, but I think that definitely allowed those who were suspicious of the term, as Steve alluded to later, to begin to step back and say, wait a minute, okay, it's a politician, he's a white guy, he's from the South. And they connect the dots in a way that says, aha, this is grounded in something else. This is grounded in that long and torturous history of the South. And so, yes, I think people connected the dots that way.
Mm-hmm. Which is something that, and I don't know much about Joe Wilson, but I know it's frustrating for non-racist whites in the South that they are immediately assumed to harbor really deep-seated, hidden anti-African American
sentiment. Oh, yeah, there's guilt by association. I mean, you know, even here in Dallas, if I say something about being from Tyler, James and I are both from East Texas, but if I say something about being from Tyler, well, there's kind of, you know, this eyebrow goes up because it's, you know, oh, well, over there, you know.
We are talking race with Steve Blow and James Ragland, both columnists at the Dallas Morning News. You can join the conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Dallas Morning News columnist Steve Blow and James Ragland are here. Their occasional series, Talking Race, is available online at dallasnews.com. You can talk race with us this afternoon by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. James, you've made the observation in the past that we don't often speak of this president as biracial. We go straight to the fact that he has African ancestry. Why do you think that's the case?
Well, first of all, I think he self-identifies as being African-American. I think he has an African-American wife, has kids. He sort of went to an African-American, a traditional African-American church. So really all of the institutions and sort of the major influences in his life were sort of grounded in that sort of tradition and that culture. So he sort of looks the part. I mean, there have been people who are mixed ancestry who look more Anglo than black, and particularly during slavery and Jim Crow, people who were mixed race and could pass as white would do that. But he self-identifies as African-American. I also think it just sort of says something about how we don't quite know what to call him. I mean, because he is exotic, meaning he's different from all the other presidents we've had before, I think that becomes sort of an easy label for him. And I think that's okay. I mean, I think it's okay for us to call him that, but I also think it's important for us when we're talking about these issues and talking about the complexity of race, he personifies that complexity. In every sense of the word, he sort of defies, in a lot of ways, everything this country's sort of been about historically in terms of the race issue and with the race being sort of a dividing line. He sort of shattered the glass ceiling on the conversation, for lack of a better term, because he is biracial and he has ascended to the highest office in the land.
I noticed what I found to be a fascinating phenomenon. When people talk about President Obama's sister, she is almost always identified as his half-sister. In fact, I did a Google search on this, and if you type in Obama's half-sister, you get 1.34 million hits. If you type in Clinton's half-brother, you get 61,000 hits. And I wonder how much that has to do with the fact that Clinton and his brother are of the same racial background, and Obama and his sister are not, and therefore, whether people mean to or not, they feel the need to explain why they don't look the same.
I think there's some of that, but I also think there's something else that's going on. I think that by the time I think the Carters were bit better known.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry, the Clintons were obviously better known at that time, and there probably wasn't just as much curiosity about them. Again, this president is different. There have been people sort of researching his history and his heritage and trying to figure out his whole family. So I think it's as much sort of this curiosity about who this guy is. I mean, he sort of came out of nowhere in political terms. So I think people are just trying to find out as much as they can about him, about his family, about his mother, his father, his grandmother. There's been a lot of searches on his father, too, and sort of that whole sort of Kenyan background, too. But that's an excellent insight, excellent point.
What do you think about that, Steve?
Maybe it has as much to do with captions under photos. You know, it's like you got to explain. You got this, United Nations.
Who is
this woman? Yeah, you got this United Nations looking, gathering of people in the picture, and it's like, well, how the heck do they fit together? Caption writers have to go to some trouble to sort of explain. But yeah, I think it's probably about that. We are interested in his ethnicity. It's different. It's interesting. It's not traditional. And so on one level, it's interesting. On another level, I think it plays into this whole notion of him being portrayed as an alien, as not one of us. I think that's, again, the subtext to some of the most extreme reactions that we've seen against him is that, he's not like us. In so many different ways, not.
Yeah, and people are, to be honest, in keeping what Steve is saying, some people are looking for dirt, too, trying to disprove that the guy was even, a U.S. citizen and where he was born and so forth. But we also have to keep in mind he's extremely young, but he's also written a couple of books in which he sort of talked about his early upbringing and talked about his family. So that sort of created not just a buzz, but a really deep curiosity in knowing all the people with whom he's been associated with and everybody in his family. So I think there are a lot of factors sort of play into all those hits that you're getting on his sister.
Curiosity and maybe also wariness.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Grapevine and speak with Aram. Hi, Aram.
Hi, and good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two comments. I'm sure nobody cares to listen to them, but I'll say one quickly. We need to look at the issues of race in the context of that time, not with the eye of today. If I could clarify, it's as ridiculous as I say today, women shouldn't vote because when these United States of America were formed, women were not permitted to vote. So that's most of our dilemma. The other item I wanted to mention, and Chris, as you opened the show, you were mentioning, I wish people would not use term leadership for elected offices. We have a representative form of democracy. We want somebody to represent us and be a solution provider. I can speak for myself. I can screw up just fine. I don't need any leader to help me. Thanks for taking my call. You all have a good one.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks. Well, I think you're on your first point about context. I think that's an excellent point to be made. I think, you know, Steve and I have written about this before. We all have baggage, I guess. And maybe the country has no more baggage on any topic more than it has baggage on the issue of race. And I think that's part of what sort of drags down the conversation, allows us to get into muck so often. I think that's why it's such a hot button issue still, because we sort of evolved as a country, evolved as a society. Our institutions have undergone rapid changes over the last four or five decades, from the mid-50s, 60s onward. And I think a lot of neighborhoods, a lot of towns, a lot of cities are still grappling with those rapid changes. And so I think that's sort of part of it. I mean, and we often talk about race, for example, just in black and white terms, but we see this a lot on the immigration issue, for example, being right here in Texas and getting the brunt of sort of illegal immigrants coming to the country. You can't write about immigration or those type of issues and without getting some really rude and crude comments online, for example, in our stories. I mean, which really sort of gets at sort of the attitudes that people have about not just illegal immigrants, but about immigrants in general. And I, when I read those, I just wonder, do they not know sort of the history of our own country, you know, and what, you know, that this great melting pot, this great experiment, that we have going on here. But I think you make an excellent point.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Ann in Dallas. Hello, Ann.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Hi. I just had a thought or question. My husband and I talk about this constantly, is the question of race versus class. In that, I was brought up in Dallas. I was brought up in South Oak Cliff. My husband was brought up in North Dallas, around the Hillcrest High School area. We both had extremely different backgrounds growing up. And we went through the explosion of times changing in Dallas. And we have come to realize ourselves that we want what we have in our life right now for everybody else. I mean, we want it for everybody. We want the best of everything for everybody. And the point I'm trying to make is we get confused when people of other backgrounds fall back on racial stereotypes themselves. Therefore, we think it's more of a class issue than a race issue. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and let me just, for clarification, are you white?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and approximately, do you mind telling us how old you are so we can get a sense of when you grew up in Dallas?
Oh, I'm 60.
Okay.
I went through blockbusting in South Oak Cliff.
All right. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for your call. That is an interesting point, that there's discrimination in terms of race and then there's discrimination in terms of class. And it's very hard to tease out which is which.
Yeah. And I think that's part of what plays into Obama's otherness, as I've been trying to call it, that he's Harvard educated and obviously has ascended into an upper class and holds himself and conducts himself in a way that really speaks of a certain upper class. And frankly, I think that just rubs a lot of people the wrong way, and sort of exacerbates some of the resentments that might be there. You know, if we want to really peel back into the history. I know the previous caller said, let's quit talking about history, but we can't escape it entirely. Uppity was a word that got used
that
a
word.
Lot. Uppity, you know, and somehow that was and I hate to say it, but I think that plays a little bit into some of the resentments against him that he's perceived as being uppity.
Which is so interesting because he was not born with a silver spoon in his mouth.
No, not at
all. He earned everything
that
he's
achieved.
Yeah,
that's why I say he ascended. He wasn't born into the upper class, but I think we could agree that he has ascended through, you know, smarts and hard work.
You know, and I do think there's a race and sort of a class struggle that's going on in this country. And I think when we have these conversations, we do often sort of blur the lines in terms of issues that are often where there's sort of class conflict or socioeconomic conflict, cultural conflict. It's easy for us to kind of call it a racial conflict when there's some other factors that really are sort of driving the tension or driving the sort of the wedge between us. So I think you make an excellent point about that. When I was growing, I think I've said this on the show before, but when I was growing up, for example, I quickly realized that when I would travel and, say, come into a big city like Dallas, I grew up in a small town in East Texas, and my best friend, he's a teacher out in Hill College now, by the way, a little plug for the college on the Hill. But JP and I were best friends, and he was a white guy, and we had a lot in common, and he was an athlete, and I was sort of an athlete, so I ran in different circles. But JP and I were really, you know, best friends for life. And if I came to Dallas and if there was a black kid living in Dallas and in a big city and in a, brick home in a tight neighborhood, I had less in common with that person than I had with JP because we culturally, we were just in tune. I mean, we both, the small town environment. So we had far more in common than I would with some another black kid, a teenager who may be from Dallas or New York or San Francisco for that matter. I think what we have to – this is what the caller is getting at, I believe. You know, I think race is a – clearly it's a defining characteristic, and it's not one that we should be afraid to talk about. It's not one that we should be afraid to acknowledge. The question becomes, we can't allow that to be the way we entirely define someone. It's not enough to say Obama's a black president. What does that mean? His experience with blackness is far different than, say, my experience with blackness or John Wiley Price's experiences with blackness growing up in Forney, Texas, for example. So that's where the conversation has to get to, where we can mature to the point where we can acknowledge another person's race or ethnicity and background and not let that be the sort of the sole and single way that we stereotype or define that person.
I wonder what you both think about this. I think most people would agree that the white American majority holds by far the lion's share of responsibility for the problems that we've had in this country with racism. On the other hand,
I'd agree with that. I don't know what that's.
Well, let me see what else she says.
And you know, but people today will talk about racism on all sides. You'll hear a white person calling an Asian racist, or there are a variety of ways of doing this. I wonder though if people who have fought long and hard to make sure that all Americans understand how detrimental racism is and how pervasive it has been, if there needs to be a readjustment of the instant sort of jumping on someone for making what sometimes is an innocent comment in terms of the ability to really have an open discussion. Sometimes people are afraid of saying anything for fear that they're about to say the wrong thing.
Oh, absolutely. That really, when James and I first began to do these periodic talking race columns, that was one of the points that I wanted to hammer on the most, and that is that we have got to turn down the heat a little bit on this topic and learn to, you know, to talk to each other and turn down our own heat, because I think we all tend to sort of, you know, bristle and get emotional and you know, we could see it in the emails that came to this last talking race. We're just introducing the topic of race in terms of, you know, opposition to Obama just set so many people off. How dare you, you know, make this about race? And it's like, come on now. We're not making it all about race. We're just trying to discuss, you know, one little aspect of it. And let's calm down and talk.
Well, but then on the other hand, I have to imagine that there are people who say we got where we are today by turning up the heat. And maybe it's not time yet to settle down and sort of live and let live.
I think that's part of white resentment these days. When you get into the history thing, there's a certain, you know, white school of thought that says, you know, can't we move on? Please, let's, you know, do we have to hash this out at every turn?
Yeah, you know, in some ways, we do need to recalibrate the conversation for a lot of reasons. You know, in some ways, you know, the 50s and the 60s, as heated as the conversations were, as violent as events became, we could get our arms around that. I mean, it was pretty black and white, no pun intended. Yeah. I mean, you could really see there were sharp differences. We lived apart. We worked apart for the most part. And now, over the last 40 or 50 years, you know, we do live in a much more integrated society. A lot of those racial barriers have come down. So the question becomes now, how do we keep talking about it and not forget history, but not let history be the thing that sort of like drives us apart, but rather sort of brings us together? I think one of the callers earlier made that point, Iram, I believe, who talked about we have to talk about race in context. I mean, the reality is, you know, there is no slavery anymore here. There is no the Jim Crow laws have been struck down, right? All those things. So we have made progress, but I think there are still vestiges of those twin evils, if you will, that remain. And one of those vestiges is sort of like, my parents and grandparents and people have been around. It's just hard for them to sort of forget that. So we have to acknowledge that, but not assume that everyone who's addressing an issue right now is coming at it from some place of hatred. And so I think that's a really key point that has to be made.
We are talking race with columnist James Ragland of the Dallas Morning News and Steve Blow of the Dallas Morning News. We will take more of your calls and emails in just a moment. You can get to us on the phone at 1-800-933-5372. Our email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Dallas Morning News columnists Steve Blow and James Ragland. They write about a variety of things, but they have been collaborating on an occasional series called Talking Race. You can find the entire archive of columns and video discussions and online chats all at dallasnews.com. If you'd like to join the conversation, that number is 1-800-933-5372. I wonder if there are certain subject lines that you all receive when you get an email comment that you think, oh, no, I better have another cup of coffee before I open this one.
Pretty much all the emails that come in under – it's funny. I don't know. There are some nice ones, but I would say that, you know, the bulk of the – I don't know if this is true for James, but the bulk of the emails I get are pretty heated. I hear the better comments, you know, or the supportive comments – only later in more face-to-face kind of meetings. But the people who sort of get to the bottom of the column and click on that email thing are usually, you know, exercised about something.
Do you both feel like it's always apparent instantly what race the writer is?
A lot of times. I mean, sometimes people will say something that will sort of tip their hands a little bit. But I've sort of been wrong a couple of times in sort of reading those too. But I can generally sort of peg the person fairly easily. The subject line that I always get bothered by, if it has to do with politics or almost all of these issues that we write about, if it's about race or if it's about Obama, if I see, you know, sort of Bush in the tagline or whatever, I mean, you know, there's always these notions or comparisons of, hey, you guys weren't writing about this when, you know, when Bush was in office. I mean, in other words, the partisan stuff. I mean, the people's capacity to reduce everything two-party politics just amazes me. I mean, it's hard to write about any issue anymore, even in a local metropolitan section where it doesn't get reduced to partisan politics. I mean, you could write about something happening at City Hall, and you might quote an Hispanic city council member, and you start reading the online comments, and all of a sudden we're talking about immigration again. We're talking about our neighbor. I mean,
this is trash pickup, not immigration.
Yeah, but I'm sort of always sort of amazed by that. And I try to bring people back around and say, hey, let's just sort of talk about the issue and not sort of, get distracted by all this other stuff.
Well, what do you both think about the fact, we have Michael Steele, who is chairman of the GOP, and there are people who say, yeah, he's qualified, we like what he does, and that's why he's there. There are other people who sort of look askance at his appointment and say he was chosen to send a message. And I wonder how fair that is to Michael Steele.
Well, I think it's entirely fair. It's politics, right? All fair in politics. Look, I think Michael Steele, the Republican Party needed to appoint someone like Michael Steele if it wants to send a signal that it's got a bigger tent, if it wants to attract more minority voters, Hispanics and African-Americans and others. I think it was important for them sort of symbolically to show that they're serious about that. Okay, now, exact appointment of Michael Steele, you can sort of debate that about his qualifications, whether he was the right guy for the job or not. I believe I met Michael Steele when I was up in the Washington area for a while, but he seems like a pretty talented, sort of a talented guy. Maybe there are people that were sort of better positioned and to serve in that capacity. But when you step into that role, you got to be ready for criticism and partisan snipes and the like. And he stumbled a few times early on. I think he sort of stumbled out of the gate. He was put in an odd spot because he's sort of as an African-American head of Republic, working on the other side of the political aisle. The fact that you got the first black president here, there were some that think that they just sort of put him in there to sort of be, sort of carry the dirty water for the party, if you will. That would sort of give some shield to these
See, we like black people.
Yes.
That kind of idea.
Yeah, and give a shield to those who might want to sort of just make unfounded attacks against the president.
But James, you used a word there that I think is a little bit of a problem. Symbolically, something they need to do symbolically. And I think, I hope we're getting to the point where we can quit doing things for symbolic reasons. I think it's sort of the legacy, the blowback from affirmative action is that, black people who've earned a job fair and square still have to, deal with the idea of, is this tokenism? Were you handed this job as a symbol, or did you earn this job through your, smarts and hard work? And I look forward to the day that all that stuff mess is behind us because we aren't having to do things symbolically or as a way of,
Point well made and point well taken, but in reality, in politics, the man certainly has to have some substance, and you would hope that the party was smart enough to bring someone who had some heft to the table and someone who could deliver what they were looking for. That said, everything in politics represents something. I mean, politics and symbolism go hand in hand.
True.
And neither party ever makes a decision at that level where they haven't sort of thought about how this would sort of play out with the base of the party and what the potential might be for sort of attracting new followers or new members. And I think that was certainly part of the political calculus that the Republican strategists had in mind when they tapped Steele.
Let's go next on the phones to Tony in Dallas. Hello, Tony.
Hi. What I wanted to say was this. How do you define African-American? I mean, traditionally in this country, what we mean by that is somebody who is the descendant of people who came here and experienced the Middle Passage, went through Jim Crow, and experienced a history of discrimination that a black person goes through in this country. Obama, who I love, I voted for, and I'll vote for again, is the son of a white woman and of opinion. And he is a black man, but is he truly an African-American in the sense that somebody like Jesse Jackson is an African-American?
Well, thank you very much for your call. It's an interesting point,
I don't think we have enough time to settle that here. But African American just became shorthand for black, basically. I mean, in the way we use language now, it's like we've gone from being called Negro to colored to Afro-American, African-American, black. It's just shorthand for...
Well, and it's also an example of how complicated this has become, because if I understand the sort of the subtext of what the caller is saying is, Obama's not black enough, which is a weird thing that black people have to deal with, you know, because is your experience authentically black enough to make you, you know, really black or whatever? And that, you know, that's a whole weird thing to me. But that's out there, too. You know,
I think what he's saying more pointedly is that is this a misapplication of the term to call him an African-American? When we say African-American in this country, there's a sense that, as he said, you sort of came through slavery and that passing, that there's a specific connotation to that. And I do think it's a term that's sort of that's often misapplied. But again, I think it's just shorthand in our culture for black. It's not. I don't think it truly reflects sort of the cultural experience of a lot of blacks or the heritage of a lot of blacks in this country, but it's just shorthand.
Well, I know that you guys have sort of dealt with this issue before. People have said, James, that you somehow are not black enough. And, Steve, no one has said that you're not white enough.
Thank you very much.
but it is something that I think maybe is harder for white people to understand, this, like, additional pressure from within the culture and outside the culture to define yourself and be a prototype in a way that I don't think that European Americans can recognize.
No, that's part of the baggage that I'm, you know, don't have to deal with. I'm grateful, and it just, you know, sort of boggles me that I guess it is part of the baggage that we're still dealing with.
Yeah, it's an issue I've dealt with since I was younger. It's an issue I dealt with in this city for 25 years when I was covering City Hall, and I'd go over to parts of this city in southern Dallas and Oak Cliff and try to write about issues that were affecting people there. And so this idea that sometimes even black folks sort of play the race card, yes, we'll sort of play it against each other too. I mean, I've had to sort of deal with that issue. Like you got to kind of show your race card to mean that you really are sort of down with the program. You understand what the problems are. It is unfortunate that still exists. And at the heart of what you're talking about is this whole notion of sort of like acting white, for example. I remember. I could never be more offended than when someone would say that, you know. And they would say it in part because of the way I spoke, because of the way in which I approached my life, the way in which I approached school and that sort of things. They would say it sometimes because of the associations, because I really did associate with people from all backgrounds and colors. I just didn't. That's just the way I was sort of brought up, right? But I also thought when people would say that, they were selling themselves short. When you would use a term like acting white and saying, what does that mean? We've had that conversation before, too. I mean, so if I am serious about my studies, if I have command of the king's language, that's somehow acting white? No, that's acting American. That's acting like I want to get ahead in life. That's acting like I care about school and care about my community. So, that's a term that's been bandied about quite a bit, and another one that's sort of been abused in so many ways.
Well, the odd thing about that term, too, is that depending on who applies it to you, it is either considered a grave insult, or if a white person tells you somehow, oh, you act white, they mean for you to take this as some kind of compliment.
Exactly right. And I take it. Now, look, there's a time and a place to have a civil conversation about that. And I have actually, when someone has said that to me, I've said to them occasionally, like, what do you mean? And I'll say, well, you don't know enough black people. I mean, because people say that. White people have said that to me. You don't act black. And I'm like, well, what does that mean? And they would allude to some of those things I mentioned earlier. And I would simply say, well, you simply don't know a lot of black people. Look, before the Cosby Show came along, I mean, really, the way we sort of, even a lot of black people looked at black America, and, you know, even some black people struggle, lest we forget, you know, when the show took off in the 80s, people thought it was an unrealistic portrayal of African American life, that you'd have two black professionals with fairly well-behaved kids able to pay their bills. They had just never seen anything like that. Well, luckily for me, I mean, being the son of two working-class parents who struggled to pay their bills, I also knew other black people who were from a different class, I mean, who were professionals, who were professors and in the medical profession and the like. So I knew those people existed. But that has a lot to do with sort of stereotyping that we talked about earlier. And it has a lot to do with the way we really have sort of advanced on the racial score in this country, too, that we now see that those sort of people exist.
Do you think it's helpful, Steve, to compare ourselves and where we are today with race in this country to other sort of Western democracies? I'm thinking about Europe, where people have expressed a lot of admiration for the fact that Barack Obama got elected, but have said it could not happen here.
Well, I think it's useful to be reminded that this is part of the human condition. It seems like, you know, around the world that it, the lines may shake out a little bit differently. But, you know, what sometimes I think, you know, you hear people portray this, as if the United States has this, you know, special sin or whatever. And, you know, we've got the sin of being human, I guess, and that is humans tend to divide themselves one way or another. So I think it's helpful in that way to just be reminded that, you know, it's something that one way or another people deal with everywhere around the world.
Let's go on the phones now to Fort Worth, and we'll speak with Tony. Hi, Tony.
Hello. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
My comment is, the topic I understand is about race, and what I'm concerned about, and what I think a component that this country is missing is the fact that Mr. Wilson interrupting the president alone, aside from the fact that our president is African-American, is the fact that he was disrespectful. And I think that that's kind of a root to a lot of some problems in this country, is the fact that there is a lack of respect. I mean, he is the president. And aside from that, yes, he is black, but that shouldn't make a difference. There is a lot of disrespect in this country, and that's my comment.
Thanks, Virgo.
Well said. You know, one reason we do the column is for the very reason that you just described there. We want to show people that there is a way to sort of have a constructive dialogue. You know, I can disagree with Steve Blow without having to shout and scream. But we have lost civility. We have sort of lost our way in terms of how we talk about sensitive issues and whether political disagreements or religious disagreements and the like. So I think your point is absolutely on the mark.
Which was the thing Colin Powell said that, you know, in the aftermath of all this, he asked a comment. He said it's mostly about civility and the lack thereof. So, you know, again, showing that not all black people think alike, you know, even Colin Powell saw it more as our caller did, as a respect issue.
Briefly, are there things that each of you, and I know you've been friends for years, but are there qualities that each of you showed to each other that let you know it was okay to start having conversations like these?
You know, Steve, I think I wouldn't be the only one to say this. It's just immensely approachable. I think if you I sort of watch him, people sort of come in out of his cubicle all the time. He really is one of those guys. He's sort of I call him sort of the dean of the columnists of those three Metro columns. He's been at this for a long time. He's a trustworthy figure. I think he's incredible. He's been doing this for a long time. So I immediately felt comfortable talking with him about anything. I just think he's just immensely approachable. And I think I wouldn't be the only one in the newsroom to say that you feel like you could walk up to him and talk to him about anything. And I also didn't think that I didn't think he came from an athletic tradition, you know, like playing football in Tyler. So I wasn't afraid to sort of like get in a row with him. I wasn't afraid he was going to like body slam me or anything like
that. The original 90-pound weakling.
Steve Lowe and James Ragland, both are columnists for the Dallas Morning News. All the segments in their occasional series, Talking Race, remain available online at dallasnews.com. Guys, it's always a pleasure.
Thanks,
Thank you, Chris, so much. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.